Shrink Wrap Radio number 680, AI, Robotics, and Chasing the Singularity, with Matthew Dolitz and Richard Hill.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Australians Matthew Dolitz and Richard Hill are longtime digital friends and strategic collaborators with Shrink Wrap Radio. Together, they host the paid subscription magazine and podcast known as The Science of Psychotherapy. Recently, they've been working on a yet-to-be-released feature-length documentary about artificial intelligence, tentatively titled Toward Singularity. I'm curious to find out the story behind this venture and how they got involved and how they see it interfacing with their interests in psychotherapy. These and related questions will be the focus of today's episode. Our sponsor for today's show is BetterHelp.com, the world's largest platform for online counseling and psychotherapy. Now, here's the interview. Matthew Dolitz and Richard Hill, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, Dr. Dave.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
Yeah, you've had me on your guys' podcast a couple of times, and I'm flattered to be featured on your website as one of your experts on your Science of Psychotherapy website, and also to have created a couple of online courses offered there. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're honored to have you on our platform, and we're both long-term listeners of Shrink Wrap Radio. So it's a real pleasure to be here too.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I hope people pop into the academy and have a look at the course you've put up. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Along with all the other bits and pieces, but there's the plug. So fantastic. Get back to it, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Matt, I know your interest in technology is not entirely new because a while back ago, you were doing something called The Age of Robots, which was to be a sort of a paid subscription magazine. And I wrote several pieces for that. And then I had the impression that you backed off of it because there just wasn't enough market response for it to get traction.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so a number of years ago, we started ageofrobots.net. It was a repository of information about emerging technology, and then we created a magazine of the same name. At the time, I think it's more about what the marketplace was willing to pay for, and they weren't willing to pay for a magazine because there's so much free information out there. But we had a good go for about a year, and you wrote quite a few articles for us as well on the psychology side and opinion side about emerging technology.
Yeah, which has been a theme in my own life. I've always been very interested in and drawn to what was happening in technology. Originally was accepted into college in electrical engineering, but switched out early on. And then as time went by and the whole tech thing started to explode, I sort of went, "Oh, I should have become an engineer." But we find other ways to back into these things and to participate. And I've been able to do that. And Age of Robots certainly gave me an opportunity to dip my finger into that.
So look, I'm thinking we should resurrect some of those old articles that you wrote and maybe put them up for listeners to be able to have a read if they're interested.
Hey, I like that idea. Yeah. Yeah, I'm always looking for ways to recycle things that I've done in the past. I find a different place to put them. So I was delighted and surprised to find out about this latest venture of a feature-length documentary on artificial intelligence and robotics. And so I have the impression, Matthew, that you're the main guy on that. So how did that come about?
Yeah, well, so my son and I have a production company called Perfect Studios, and we do a little bit of commercial work. And what we want to do is focus on documentaries. And of course, we have an interest in technology, we have an interest in the brain, and artificial intelligence seems like a good amalgamation of all of those things. So we thought we would touch base with a lot of the experts within our area. So we're in Brisbane, Australia, and do a little documentary about where we're up to with artificial intelligence. And Richard and I, we're always talking about how we're complex systems and how our nervous systems are such complex systems. And so to have a conversation about how are we artificially trying to emulate this very complex system, I thought would be an interesting investigation. And indeed it was.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you were able to share a preview of the film with me, which I was glad to be able to see. And I was struck by with my American-centric self to see how much was going on in Australia and how much expertise there was there. You had some really good people to tap into.
Yeah, so we've got some remarkable people here. There's the Queensland Brain Institute. They do a lot of, well, as the name suggests, research on the brain. And there are people there that are also looking at how to use information, use knowledge about how the brain works, and turning that into algorithms. And similarly, there's other institutions. We've got the Queensland University of Technology, and they've got some departments which are very deeply involved in artificial intelligence and robotics. And we were able to touch base with those people. So half the people on the interviewees in the documentary are professors. Very, very knowledgeable and leading edge.
Yeah.
And here we have a government-run institution, CSIRO. They have a department, Data 61, and they also are steeped in robotics and artificial intelligence. And so we're able to interview a few of those people as well, and the very interesting robotics and artificial intelligence projects that they have happening.
So are you saying that the government there is investing in this technology, helping to support it and grow it as an industry?
Absolutely, yes. So there is government money flowing into artificial intelligence and developing these things. I mean, it really is the cutting edge of the new world. So
yeah, I think that's smart of them to do that. And Richard, you're in the film as the voice of an artificial intelligence. Do you have experience as a robot, or how does this come to happen?
I get to resurrect my previous history as almost sort of prior life, because actually some people are aware, but I was a professional actor for nearly 25 years.
Oh yeah.
And it was amusing. I was at a workshop the other day where I was participating. It was for learning our first aid, for so that when poor patients have trouble, we heal them. God help, don't ever happen to me. But the teacher said, "Oh, someone read out the slide," which was a nice idea to get people to read. So I read it out a little bit, and then someone else in the room said, "Wow, that sounds like a voice, like a television show."
Right.
But yeah, so we're using that sort of skill, you know, which is useful from that perspective. But also, I've always said that people who do voiceovers, people who are on commentary of any form, that you can tell when they know what they're talking about and when they're just reading the lines off the page.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bring that as well, which is exciting. But what we do, and one of the things I just wanted to add from before, we're talking about government support and things, and I think what makes Australia an interesting place is we do have the government support and the financial support, but it's a fraction of what you've got in other countries, particularly like America. So not only do we have the sort of support, but by gee, you've got to be smart and clever and cluey and really make value out of every dollar. And I think that's what triggers a lot of the ingenuity out here.
Yeah. I'm thinking of you as maybe a method actor, and that you needed to contact your inner robot.
Well, it was pretty easy. Matt said, just say it without terribly much emotion, and I just pretended to be a psychotherapist.
Richard really is very talented in his voiceover work, and we're doing another documentary for the Air Force, who are a number of different squadrons that are now defunct, and we're doing a historical documentary of which Richard will be the narrator, so we'll look out for that one. I think what Richard really brings to the table, quite apart from voiceover on our documentary, is a deep understanding of the complexity of our nervous system, of the brain. And I just think it's a really interesting conversation when it comes to how we're emulating the brain, what the general perception is of artificial intelligence, how far along we really are, because from doing this documentary and from other research that we've done, we are really very, very basic in our emulation of our nervous system, of our brains. So when we talk about artificial intelligence, first we have to define what do we mean by intelligence? What's the definition of intelligence? And there's been different sort of the goalposts have moved along the way as we've had artificial intelligence to first, you know, beat us at chess. And so we then, you know, said, well, okay, that was intelligent, but maybe not intelligent enough. And then we have artificial intelligence beat us at Go. Well, that's really intelligent, but maybe not intelligent enough. And so the goalposts of what is intelligent and what does artificial intelligence needs to achieve to be as intelligent of as us, keeps moving.
I thought that was a really interesting point that came through in the film. I had not ever really thought of it that way. And now I guess the latest achievement was that it became a Jeopardy champion. Which feels like maybe it's getting us closer to general intelligence, except that it's really about having a huge database of factual knowledge that the Jeopardy champion is able to draw upon. And that's the kind of thing that computers can excel at.
Yes, it's fact-based. So still unable to move themselves out of the linear a causal framework where there's a pathway that you end up at the correct answer. Whereas, of course, human intelligence is you can go along a pathway and end up at a totally surprising and unexpected and unpredictable answer that may not even have anything to do with what you're talking about in the first place. So although we don't do it in the film, it's really interesting looking at artificial intelligence being creative. You know, doing paintings and quite often the comments that people do, critics give of such artwork is very interesting, but still derivative. Mm-hmm. So
that's right.
Still coming from initial frameworks of programming and so possibility is still limited to what is programmed in.
Yeah. So are either one of you up to giving our listeners and viewers some kind of very compact definition of what we mean by artificial intelligence, particularly given that it's a moving target?
Yeah, that's for Matt. Away you go.
Yeah. Yes, it is a moving target. And I guess very broadly, it's the capacity to emulate, you know, what we would perceive from another person as being intelligent, to be able to respond intelligently. And so we come back to the Turing test, you know, where if you're talking to, you're not sure if it's a robot or a person, you're sort of, you know, behind a screen, whatever that screen might be, and you can't discern whether it's a computer or a person, then that's supposed to be a test to demonstrate a level of artificial intelligence. But like we've just been talking about, intelligence, depending on how you define it, could be in a very constrained area. You know, we've got a Watson, medical Watson, that can, you know, diagnose illnesses based on a group of symptoms very well, very accurately, because it has access to hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of data points on similar symptoms and what those diseases actually are. And so I guess the intelligence, quote unquote, is probably more about access to big data banks and being able to then tease out an accurate answer, as opposed to maybe what we'd say is the wisdom of a doctor with experience in front of you, talking to you about your symptoms and in his experience, what that may or may not be.
One of the things that people worry about is being replaced by computers. And I think a lot of the research currently suggests that it can be a really good collaboration for a human and computer to work together using the strengths of each, so that the experienced physician brings a kind of some kind of wisdom based on experience, some kind of a broader pattern that he can draw upon that feels intuitive, whereas the computer is kind of constrained to what's exactly in its database.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that je ne sais quoi. And this is the trouble of it. It was really interesting, though, with Deep Blue. And I know you've got some more to say, Matt. But with Deep Blue, when they were doing the chess thing in the initial stages, I'm not sure it was Kasparov that was playing at the time, but the way that the human being won was to actually do some stupid moves. And it just, the computer wasn't programmed to anticipate, you know, totally unexpected, unreasonable behavior.
Yeah.
That's what they then computed in, figured out how to compute in. And this is what we see in the film, where one of the chaps is working out algorithms and mathematical equations for emotional behavior. And it's kind of a bit interesting, a little freaky, but so fascinating that it is possible to think in that way, that you can do that.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is, so at the moment, artificial neural networks, they're very simple, although, I mean, they're complex, but in one way, they're very simple connections of artificial neuron, which is weighted in different ways as it learns, and it's in this network, it's in a neural network, albeit artificial.
It said just a footnote, it's taking place in software. So these artificial neurons or artificial neuronal networks are software, computer software.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So weighted links and connections in a very complex web that learns and can learn and have different weights within all of the connections to come to have a certain output. Yeah, so to be able to recognize through vision, recognize that this is a cat, and to be able to output that's a cat. Now the interesting thing that this is an emulation of one kind of layer of our nervous system, and that is so the neural connections and the weights of the synaptic connections from one neuron to another. But we also have the whole glial network around the neuronal network, which is another form of not just support for the neurons, but another almost like a slow-moving communication network. And then if you listen to people like Stuart Hameroff, there could be a really fast quantum kind of network as well within neurons. And so we have a lot of layers and a lot more complexity in our nervous system, which artificial neural networks don't even touch.
Right, right. Because we've got something, if I recall from the film, I think a number that was given was 100 billion neurons in the brain. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's almost that. There've just been recent research where it's been more accurately said about 86 billion. But I give or take a billion around that.
Right. But then there are the number of interconnections. And so sort of logarithmically increases the complexity that's there.
Absolutely.
Maybe 4,000 or 5,000 connections on each average, on average. That's a pretty big, that's pretty well connected. And as Matt says, glial cells, then glial cells, depending on where you're from. Then we have quantum aspects. Then we have extracellular biochemical communications going on as well. It just keeps, but this is where it gets interesting with when you're saying, Dave, about we're working on software. Our next hardware change will, of course, be quantum computing. Will that be the thing that changes it? Will that, is it the hardware that we need to actually change in AI that is going to change this, this more liquid, this more fluid, this more, not just on and off, but on and off at the same time? Is that what we do in our brains? The, this question is still a long way from being answered.
Yeah. I think that we're going to eventually have to go to more of a biological, something more brain-like, maybe piggybacking on existing animal brains or something like that to get the density that's required. But of course, that's entirely speculative. Let me break in here for a moment to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp.com, an online therapy site. Did you know that BetterHelp is the largest online counseling platform worldwide? They change the way people get help with facing life's challenges by providing convenient, discreet, and affordable access to a licensed therapist. BetterHelp makes professional counseling available anytime, anywhere, through a computer, a tablet, or a smartphone. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. Also, you can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. I like to test out the services I recommend, and so I had a number of video sessions with BetterHelp therapist Marjorie Fagan. I was really impressed by her deep listening. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily. For example, here's one from today. I quote, "In the short time I've been working with Cameron Marshall, she has helped me lessen my anxiety and provided multiple recommendations to help me deal with the challenges of an aging parent. She is quick to respond and is very kind." That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com, and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Shrink Wrap Radio listeners get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/shrink. Once again, that's betterhelp.com/shrink. Now, back to the interview. Now, the title of the version of the film that I saw was The Singularity. So we have to mention Ray Kurzweil, who's written speculated quite a bit by what he calls the singularity, which is the idea that we would eventually come to a singularity in the sense of an utterly unique event that's never happened before in the universe, which would be computers with what we would call general intelligence. In other words, they would be as or more intelligent than we are now. I think most people in computer science and in the artificial intelligence arena are saying that we're a long ways away from realizing that at this point, that it's still pretty much in the realm of science fiction.
That's right. So one of the interesting things that came out of our interviewing with these primarily academics, we did talk to some people that are actually working out in the field from freelance robotics, but primarily academics. And the surprising thing was that they were pretty unanimous in saying that we still have a long way to go. And the apocalyptic, you know, artificial general intelligence taking over the world is a fairly unlikely scenario. Which is comforting.
Yeah, right.
And we are the creators of you know, these systems, and so we've got some pretty clever people developing these systems. Now, that's not to say that, you know, systems that are created, you know, can't be used for evil, or I mean, there's lots of examples in history where technology, you know, has been turned against us. However, with the idea of artificial general intelligence and this singularity, and the term singularity, the metaphor is in, you know, a black hole, whether you have the singularity between the outside environment and then the within the black hole, you can't see beyond the singularity. So it's this idea that we can't possibly see beyond this point in time as to what outcomes there'll be. But the overwhelming majority of people were saying that we may reach artificial general intelligence at some point in time, and their estimations are all varied. But it's not going to be this apocalyptic, you know, end of the human race, beginning of a, you know, the robots kind of scenario.
We become the slaves or the pets of the robots. That's one of the more optimistic views, as opposed to they just get rid of us because we're the problem.
Well, I think one of the sort of imaginative, you know, sort of fictional versions of a robot that has been probably, I think, the one that has the most reality to it is from Star Trek. The Data was in the Next Generation episodes with Captain Picard and all those guys, and fabulously intelligent, fabulously quick, could do things humans couldn't do, but still looked upon Picard as the father figure. He still needed a learning experience. He still needed to grow up, even with that. And I think that certainly is the closest we've come to a warming. Because otherwise, you know, we have in Star Wars the R2-D2 and you're sort of semi... They're much less sophisticated than good old Data in Star Trek. But that's quite... an interesting option for them to go to, as different from Asimov's, you know, sort of out there in 2001, sort of doing all kinds of odd things. So interesting stuff, the forward thinking. But this is one of the comments that one of the people made in the film. The lass is saying, yeah, fiction, great. Actually, it's so exciting now. Don't worry about the fictional stuff. Get really excited about the stuff we're doing right now, because it's really, really interesting now.
Yeah.
And another interesting thing that came out in our interviewing, and not a lot of it really got into the documentary. I mean, we're trying to bring 4 or 5 hours of interviews down to a 1 hour documentary.
So
we had to, you know, do some cutting. Sure. But this idea of embedded technology and technology becoming more and more invisible and yet pervasive and powerful is really interesting. So we're getting technology which is becoming smaller, more discreet and more powerful and influencing our lives and enhancing our lives in different ways, and yet it's from all outward appearances, it's not as obvious as you might think.
Well, we should probably let's talk a little bit about how it impacts our profession as therapists, as people helpers, healers, however you want to think of it, because we know that artificial intelligence is making incursions into the workplace. And you know, and there's a big debate about, you know, is this going to put people out of work? Well, already it's clearly put some people out of work. The question is, will it put everybody out of work? And that begins to get into the science fiction area. But we already have situation. One of the things I've been following and doing interviews around is what I'm calling psych tech. There's some other word for it. I don't know. But there are a variety of devices out there now, companies that are producing them to help people meditate or to focus better or to be less anxious and so on. And, you know, some of that's very interesting. Some of the people I've interviewed, devices, sometimes wearable, to teach or aid in mindfulness, meditation, give feedback, neurofeedback from the brain. Heart rate variability is turning out to be a big one. There's the Oura Ring, which measures several things, and they've got a bunch of competitors. I interviewed neuroscientist Dr. Amy Sarin with a product called Touch Points, which are little vibrating things that you can put in your socks or use like wrist watches for anxiety. And Ariel Garten has something called the Muse Meditation Trainer. I interviewed her. The people at HeartMath, they've got a device that tracks heart rate variability. And I've got an upcoming interview, it may be the very next one, is Dr. David Rabin, who I just learned about. He's a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist and is the chief investigator for a company called Apollo Adaptogenic Stress Reduction Device. So yeah, there's a ton of that stuff. And what does that mean for us? How much trust do we put in it? Not to mention, forget about the not to mention. I'll mention it later.
Okay. I think these tools are all very they're very interesting and they can be very powerful given if you know what you're doing with them. When we're talking about like a heart rate variability monitors, so we're looking at the flexibility of the autonomic nervous system, how easily we shift from sympathetic parasympathetic balance based on the distance between each heartbeat. There's some complex algorithms in there to work that out and to give some sort of understanding of the flexibility of our autonomic nervous system. I wouldn't say it's artificial intelligence, although it's intelligent to a certain degree in a very, very specific way. But the real intelligence is the therapist that is working with the person to interpret and to give advice and to lead according to whatever the information that machine gives you. Same with EEG and every other monitoring device that we attach to ourselves.
Yeah. So so it's looking like it'll be augmenting an augmentation of a human therapist, maybe another tool in the tool belt for at least some kinds of conditions.
Now I can imagine, and we've actually changed the beginning of the documentary since you've seen that first rough cut, and we have a jogger who's out, jogging in the bush, and he gets a call from his central monitor, who has picked up a number of different things physiologically that suggest he might be having a heart attack, and so the AI, gives him a call and says, "We're just suggesting that you might just want to just slow down now. We're sending this information to your doctor. We'll get back to you in just a moment."
And that was just in the news just last night. On the news, there was a story about this teenager, and he was alerted by his iPhone that his pulse was up to 196, and he should get himself to a doctor quickly.
Yeah.
these immediate things. I mean, I just saw some advertisements. I'm a recent grandpa, so I see, look at things for diapers, and there's a diaper that can buzz your iPhone and tell you that your, you know, the nappy's wet. And these are terrific things, but I just want to drop in the reminder, and always the thing that's my interest and the concern is that what we're doing, you know, what are we doing with having all these additions, which we haven't had before, but we have them now. And one of the reasons is because it's a new form of evolution where our body is no longer keeping up with the changes of in our environment. And probably our body's about 15,000 years back, our genome. As a lovely book I read, it said our genome is like a pissed off teenager that doesn't know the room it's in. But so we've had social evolution, so psychosocial evolution. So we've managed to be able to think ourselves into managing these sedentary groups and large numbers of population and so on and so forth, and all these types of employment activities that give us stress and produce our dietary programs that change our bodily appreciation and cause these problems. And here we are again. My worry is that as we keep outthinking nature, we get further and further away from it and more likely and more closer and closer to the point where if our systems that we have created break down, we actually are not able to survive in the world we live in. And this is quite fascinatingly, it's a teasing idea that we need to keep reminding that, you know, what is our naturalness and how do we get back to that?
So are you saying that there might be too much technology that is kind of like scaffolding and support around about us, and we're not able to, or, you know, practice the resilience of, you know, being in life without these things?
Well, we need it. I think is also the thing. I mean, we need air purifiers because we've created air that our bodies are no longer able to comfortably breathe. We need different forms of food additives and changes and variations because we've moved away from whole foods and things. So, yeah, so I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just suggesting that we need to notice it.
I think that's a really important point, that we're becoming, there's a danger that we will become so dependent upon these technologies that if they fail us, we're going to be in deep yogurt. For example, passwords. I have a friend who's experiencing some dementia, and he's no longer able to cope with his iPhone and his computer. Because he doesn't remember, there are passwords that you absolutely, you can't use a tool if you don't have access to your passwords. And sometimes I worry about that for myself, you know.
Yes, even the password tools that you can use, you still need to have the password to get into the password tool.
Exactly.
That's where we'll have to trust our artificial intelligent personal assistant to remember these things for us. Getting back to this technology that supports us too, there's interesting technology that's come out in the last few years, and it's called Lab on a Chip. And so being able to do different sorts of tests, primarily blood tests, and in little disposable chips that do the analysis, depending on how the complexity of the chip and what it's analyzing.
I think we're having some kind of psychic thing going on here all the way between America and Australia, because right now I'm reading this book, maybe you know it, it's Blood and Something. It's about Elizabeth Holmes, this young woman who created a company called Theranon, something like that though. And it's all about that. She was trying to get that technology into a small box, and but was claiming abilities that she wasn't able to deliver on, but somehow able to get just millions and millions and millions of dollars from all sorts of investors and VCs and big corporations because it was such a great sounding idea.
So
maybe it's here already. I don't think it's in the way that she envisioned it yet, but I think there are pieces of that puzzle maybe already.
Yeah, and they're starting right, yeah. to come. I mean, we're doing interface, one of the things in medical systems and for psychological as well, but technology interface where we use the neurobiofeedback, for example, is a technology interface in order to enable us to more successfully engage with issues in our mental state and in our therapeutic, they become therapeutic programs. So it's quite, and even more fascinating, the one I quote in my book, the Mirroring Hands book, we talk about the interface with the frozen in or locked in patients, and they developed a balance of EEG and oxygen fluctuations in the brain, and were able to interpret this language of the brain to be saying yes or no, and enable mm-hmm. these poor people who are conscious but unable to physically move to actually communicate, which sorts of extraordinary things are enormously beneficial. It's not a two-edged sword, it's about a 57-edged sword, I think.
Yeah. And it's interesting when we talk about brain interfaces, we still are only scratching the surface about how the brain works and what we know about the brain. And yet this technology that is trying to understand and emulate this very, very complex system, which we hardly understand. I think it's an interesting parallel science, artificial intelligence and neurobiology and neuroscience.
Definitely. And it's hard not to get really excited about that stuff. I find it hard not to get super excited. And then always the dark potential also will crop up in my mind, and I'm sure in other people's minds. So really it comes down to our wisdom to guide this process. And that's one of the main topics that your interviews in the film get into. Is one of the big issues with artificial intelligence is the lack of transparency that, this artificial intelligence with its reinforcement learning and all of that is coming up with some really great suggestions, but we don't know how. We don't know exactly. It's a black box. It's funny that behaviorists used to talk about the brain as a black box, and you know, B.F. Skinner famously said that he was interested only in input and output, stimulus and response. And
right.
You could deduce, you didn't need to know what was going on in the head. It seems that actually it's been terribly useful to find out what's going on in the head.
Yeah. And also another sort of angle is the biggest money and the most research is from private, companies or even, public companies, but the research is done in a secret way.
Yes, proprietary information, and they're not required to share it because it would mess with their competitive advantage.
That's right. It's all being geared for commercial advantage.
The other is another major driver in all of this are militaries, and so there's plenty of reason to from both of those angles to try to be as aware as we can and to be active as citizens. And that's another one of the points in the film that people talk about is as we get into these more and more technical areas that you have to have multiple PhDs and MDs and so on to even begin to play in that field. And yet how do you have an informed public who can help guide or senators, I don't know how it is in Australia, but the senators often seem dumb. They're older guys for the mostly guys, and they're older, and they haven't been busying themselves with a lot of details about technology, and now they have to, and judges and so on, then they have to make very important major decisions that ripple out in profound ways.
Yes.
This is an intriguing thing. There was something, an article I saw the other day, is that we're having neuronal, you know, brain research, neuroscience research, where we actually don't have the brain power to be able to figure out what it is. And thinking back to what we see in maths, I mean, the mathematics, there are a number of the Fibonacci equations and things that sometimes it's decades or even 100 years or more before somebody actually then is able to more generally explain the equation. And I think this is very much what we're talking about here, that we're beginning to fidget around trying to make some usefulness, political usefulness and commercial usefulness, out of knowledge that we're still decades away from even understanding. This period now is a time when, this way to be great, back to Star Trek again, you know, when money ceases to be an importance and everything just becomes open source, that would change, that's the next change we need in order to truly progress. And I don't know, I don't think that's coming in short term.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. When it comes to the advancement of artificial intelligence, we're on the cusp of having very clever algorithms create even more clever algorithms, computers being able to code faster, better. And so when we talk to some people about the evolution of these sort of things and how quickly, because computers can just, go through iteration after iteration very, very quickly and, work out what works, we might see an absolute explosion of very smart technology being produced by technology that wasn't as smart as what it's just produced, if that makes sense.
Well, we're examples of that in a way, right? That is, we are able to invent things that are certainly much faster, that quotes think or compute much, much, much faster than we can.
Changes. I just quickly, because they're just in the human, just keeping a little bit of the neuroscience in there and the genes. We had we've got a region in our genetics, it's called the human accelerator region. And it's in one of the gene areas. And that in itself, somehow, of course, again, we don't know how, we still don't even understand exactly what it is, but that was a major shift in the development of the human brain, which accelerated us away from the other primates. And so these sorts of connections, it's a natural thing for them to occur. So if I can bring naturalness into technology, that's possibly one of the ways that Matt was saying, this unexpected serendipitous connection that leads to explosive outcomes.
Yeah, and Dr. David Howard, who we talked to about evolutionary kind of processes that he does, he says that there's a lot of creativity that comes out of that because the algorithms are trying, so many different sort of iterations of a design, maybe, for a robot leg is one of the examples that he gives.
The algorithm itself is doing the calculations,
Yeah, so the algorithm is, it's looking for different options. Right, and then tries those options out, all in a virtual, environment, virtual world, and you have generation after generation after generation of design possibilities, right? And it can do many, many, many very quickly, much more than we could come up with ourselves. It might take us 1,000 years. A computer can do it in a couple of hours.
Yeah.
So there's the power of computing, which may exponentially increase with quantum computing, where creativity and novelty come into play purely in this artificial world, which is very interesting.
Yeah. So what have we not touched on yet? And that's one question. And another is, what are your hopes for the film?
Right, okay. So one thing we haven't touched a lot on, Dr. Nicole Robinson talks about social robotics and sort of coming to terms with working with robots and developing robots that work with within a world that is designed for humans. So when we think about, you know, walking through doors and sitting in cars and all of this, the world is designed for the human form, obviously. And so moving forward, when we're talking about putting artificial intelligence in an embodied form, so in a robot, you know, creating robots that, you know, fit within our world. And so how that sort of comes about and then our own response to these robots, you know, there's a lot of psychology involved in how we integrate with robots, how robots integrate with us. And that's a very, very interesting conversation.
Yeah. Whole other field of therapeutic activity. Yeah. Very interesting.
We easily anthropomorphize, you know, these machines as if they were, you know, sentient beings. And we can take very simple, you know, like a little dog robot, a toy, essentially. Right. But we can imagine, you know, it has feelings, for example. So when we come with very complex systems, so an Android, you know, robotic system that kind of stands next to us kind of like a human in a human form, it's very easy for us to anthropomorphize, to give it characteristics that it doesn't necessarily have, but we reflect those onto the machine.
Sure, people do that with their cars. They yeah. know the cars' names and attribute personalities to their cars. I'm talking about older cars. Now, even more so, that cars become more and more sentient, if you will. You know, oops, yeah. don't move into that lane. There's somebody over there, and here, let me park it for you because you don't know how to park yeah. very well.
Yeah.
So,
but the film, Matt, that's really at this stage, it's largely going to be sort of an internally used by the organizations that we've worked with, the university and a CSIRO, or is it got a general? Sort of exposure.
What's... Yeah, so we'll put it out there for everyone to look at. We'll have it on Vimeo on demand. Hopefully, we'll get it out onto iTunes and maybe Amazon Amazon on demand as a streaming documentary. I'll leave you a link, Dr. Dave. You might be able to put that in the show notes where people can go in. And as we put it up on different platforms, people will be able to find it there. Essentially, this was just an introduction. So this is an introduction to, there's probably a half a dozen or more in-depth documentaries that I'd love to do just based on these very introductory conversations we had with these experts. I think it's a fascinating field for anyone that's interested in technology and the brain, or either or. You know, this is something that it's happening. It's happening now. It's going to change our lives. It's going to change the planet. We should be interested. And I think this is a good introduction.
Well, that's a good wrap-up, Matthew. I think that's a good place for us to wrap it up. And I want to thank both of you guys very much for doing it and for engaging with us today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dave.
Yeah, great pleasure. Wonderful to see you and spend a bit of time.
I really appreciated this opportunity to connect with my two digital friends and collaborators in Australia about their latest project. They're both very accomplished in their own right. I was surprised to learn that they had taken on such a large project as a feature-length documentary on a topic as complex as artificial intelligence and robotics, in addition to all the other projects on their plate. One of the things I found most interesting in our discussion is that the definition of artificial intelligence is such a moving target. That is, what we are willing to accept from a machine as being truly intelligent. It's not surprising that we use our own intelligence as the yardstick, despite the fact that for a long time now, computers have been able to far outstrip our own abilities in certain domains, such as mathematical calculations and so on. What we really seem to crave, although rather ambivalently, is computers that are as clever as we are in a very broad, general way, including phenomena such as, quotes, common sense, emotional sensitivity, and creativity. I'm always struck by how quickly we humans adapt to something that only a little bit earlier would have been considered impossible or miraculous. For example, we would have thought it impossible that a computer could beat the pants off a chess master. But then it did, and we were amazed for about 5 minutes. Yes, but how about a really complicated game like Go? Okay, so a computer can excel there, but how about the TV game show Jeopardy? And so we keep moving the goalposts to the next challenge. I thought maybe the Turing test had already been passed, but there also, we keep raising the bar. Computerized bots are able to hold increasingly complicated conversations with us, but if we poke at them long enough, we're able to proudly discover lacunae of stupidity. Dalitz and Hill have generously provided a link for my audience to the documentary film which was the focus of our interview. You can check it out for yourself at https://perfectstudios. Now, Perfect Studios is spelled PerfectStudios.com/toward-singularity. Now, that's an awful lot for you to write down. If you go to the show, to this show on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com, episode number 680, you'll find it in the show notes where you can just click on it.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Diane Cronmiller from Nanaimo, Canada. I wanted to extend my sincere thanks for all the time and hard work you've poured into this important and enlightening podcast over the years. I understand it's not particularly lucrative, which makes your dedication and consistency particularly admirable. I'm celebrating my recent graduation from Athabasca University's Master of Counseling program, and it felt important that a message and donation to you be included in my closing ritual. Though we've never met, I feel a kinship with you. You've been a constant companion through a most challenging 3.3 years of online study. As someone who's not a natural academic and struggles with sedentary screen time, the opportunity your podcast gave me to learn about psychotherapy while taking long walks in nature kept me inspired throughout my studies. For most of my degree, I was living on Salt Spring, a wonderful island full of hippies, farmers, and vacationers. I often felt isolated in my academic endeavor. However, as soon as I flipped on your podcast, I had the sense of being among colleagues, learning from the best professors in the field. There were many times I felt compelled to donate, but put it off with excuses of being a poor student. Let's face it, I will likely be in student debt for a long time, and yet I still managed to spend money on things of much less value than your podcast. With this realization, I decided to contribute a humble $5 a month in support and appreciation. Thank you for all you have done towards my edification and that of the psychological community at large. With deep gratitude, Diane.
Thank you, Diane Miller. Thank you, Diane Miller, once again for so beautifully articulating the value you find in Shrink Wrap Radio. And thanks to all our ongoing financial donors, you know who you are. And thanks to two new donors, Al Gunan and Robert Lighton. Speaking of donations, we do have yet another wonderful new transcript on the site. Thanks to Lulu Island for transcribing episode number 656, Pivot Toward What Matters in Your Life, with Stephen C. Hayes, Ph.D. I regard him as both a rock star and senior statesman in our field. His new book, A Liberated Mind, How to Pivot Toward What Matters, is not so much a manual for therapists as a self-help book for everyone. Although it's based on his pioneering and extensively researched work on acceptance and commitment therapy, it's really a recipe for a satisfying life. So check out the transcripts page at shrinkwrapradio.com for episode number 656. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. Thanks to my Australian friends Matthew Dolitz and Richard Hill for discussing their forthcoming documentary film on artificial intelligence and robotics. My next guest will be David Rubin, MD, PhD, who is the Chief Innovation Officer, co-founder, and co-inventor at Apollo Neuroscience Incorporated. In this role, Dr. Rabin is developing Apollo Neuroscience's IP portfolio and running clinical trials of the Apollo technology, the first scientifically validated wearable system to improve focus, sleep, and access to meditative states by delivering layered vibrations to the skin. He's also been involved with MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, to determine the mechanisms of the dramatic psychotherapeutic benefits observed by following psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy in treatment-resistant mental illness. You definitely won't want to miss this one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.